is it gone unpunished now? Walk the streets are screaming now. Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Well, what a week, and it's still going. Lots of topics of significance in the U.S. and global economy this past week that we're going to take a shot at. Well, what's the most important? Was it Trump's deals with Mexico and Canada? He said he's going to tear up NAFTA. Did he tear up NAFTA? Well, he crossed out the name NAFTA and gave it a new one, but not much else changed. We're going to return to that. What about behind the scenes, the intensification of the trade war with China and becoming political now with this microchip? This mysterious microchip that supposedly China has embedded in all the servers of corporations and government in the U.S. Sounds like yellow cake to me. All right, we'll take that on. And what about the New York Times feature study or feature article about Trump's silver spoon? You know, Trump has said all along during the election, oh, my daddy only gave me $1 million and I had to pay it back with taxes and I bankrolled that $1 million into my massive billion-dollar plus economic empire. Well, did he? Or is that another example of Trump lying? Well, New York Times kind of took him apart on that. But there's limits to what the New York Times said. They didn't go far enough. We'll take a look at Trump's silver spoon. And what about tax cuts and wages? You know, all along, this was called the jobs bill, right? A wages bill. It's going to raise wages. What did Mnuchin say during the push for the Trump tax cuts? $5,000 in everybody's pocket or something like that. Well, now the studies are beginning to come out to show there's virtually no increase in wages going on because of the Trump tax cuts. We'll look at that. What is going on, though, is a huge run-up in the U.S. deficits and debt. Then I want to briefly talk about U.S. saber rattling going on behind the scenes. Everyone's preoccupied with this Kavanaugh deal. And what are U.S. ambassadors doing behind the scenes of the cover here? Threatening war with Russia is what they're doing. Not just in Syria, but in Russia itself. We're going to send missiles into Russia, according to the U.S. ambassador to NATO. Yeah, well, we'll look at that one. That's a scary one. But you know, the biggest story, I believe, of the past week is the rise in global financial instability and fragility. Well, what is that? I've been warning all along that the global economy is becoming more fragile. Right? Now we're beginning to see something happen this past week. You know, the Federal Reserve has been raising its rates. Yeah. Big increase the week before last by the Federal Reserve, the Central Bank of the U.S., and its chair, Jerome Powell, signaling, oh, there's a lot more coming. Okay, so the federal funds rate, the key benchmark rate, increased to 2.25%, and threats of much more coming. Now, remember, I've been saying all along that if that federal funds rate, that benchmark rate that causes all the other rates to rise, if that hits 3%, maybe even 2.75, in other words, three more raises for sure, we're going to have a crisis, a financial major correction globally, not just in the U.S., but globally. We're already seeing the cracks globally begin to appear in emerging markets. And if the 10-year treasury bill, a bond, which follows the federal funds rate, you know, rises in tandem another 0.75% to 1%, that would put the 10-year at over 4%. In 2008, the federal funds rate was raised to 5.25%, even as the economy was contracting rapidly. In other words, the Fed, the central bank, really screwed up in 2008 and has played a big role in precipitating the crisis in 2008 with its monetary policy. And you know, in past shows, we've talked about how the Fed and the Treasury played a key role in the crash of Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers. I'm not going to go over that again. But even more fundamentally, the Fed precipitated the crisis by raising rates too high and keeping them there too long. The Federal Reserve has always done this. It's always raised the rates too high and too long and has always played a role in recessions. And it's going to do it again. It's coming. But it won't take 5.25%. It'll only take 3%. Well, why? Because the U.S. economy is much more fragile. The debt load is massive, and the years and years of Fed, 6 and 7 years of near zero interest rates, have allowed companies that were zombies in the first place to keep borrowing and to keep extending their existence when they should have folded for 6, 7 years. And those zombie companies out there now, and there's a record number of them in the U.S. and globally, those zombie companies, now that rates will rise, are going to tank because they aren't going to be able to borrow at the higher rates to roll over their massive debt that they've accumulated. And we're going to see that happen. Okay, so it's much more fragile than it was before. And because of that, it won't take as high an increase in interest rates to precipitate the problem. Also, households are far more in debt than ever before. You know, this so-called recovery is not being fueled by wage increases and real income growth for most folks. It's being fueled by debt. People are borrowing, and more households are living from paycheck to paycheck and borrowing and rolling over and borrowing again, be it student debt, be it auto debt, be it credit card debt, mortgage debt, you know. Was it $13, $14 trillion the U.S. households are in debt? Half of that, you know, in credit card and autos and so forth. Student debt, installment debt, etc. And then, of course, the federal government is up to its ears in debt now, too. Why? Because of the continuing corporate and investor and business tax cutting that's been going on since George W. Bush. Over $14 trillion in tax cuts, most of which have gone to investors and businesses. We see this very clearly in the Trump tax cuts. I'm not going to go over that again. I talk about that all the time. It's really $4 to $5 trillion in tax cuts for investors, offset to some extent by $2 trillion increase in taxes for the middle class, loss of deductions and exemptions and so forth. And then a phony estimation of 10 more years of 4% economic growth without a recession allows the estimation of only $1.5 trillion of the Trump tax cuts. No, no, the rich are getting $4 to $5 trillion. Okay, remember that? Yeah, well, if you're running those huge tax cuts you're going to run huge deficits because tax cutting or taxes account for 2/3 of all the government deficits and debt. 2/3. Yeah. It's a big number, 2/3. We're at $21 trillion federal government debt. And who knows? I don't even know the number for state and local debt. That's at least another $10 trillion, right? Okay, so $21 trillion, you're going to have to pay for that somehow if you're running that deficit. Pay for it means the Fed and the Treasury selling Treasury bonds and bills and notes more than ever before. And we're going to talk about that because the Fed is raising rates in order to attract investors to buy bonds to finance that deficit. Oh, is that why interest rates are rising? Oh, some say, oh no, the interest rates are now rising sharply because the economy is doing so well. Well, if that were true, it would be short-term rates that would be rising the fastest, but it's long-term rates that are rising fastest. It's 30-year bonds and 10-year bonds. It's not the short term. Okay, well, we'll come back and visit that before the show's over and talk about the deficit and debt as a result of the tax cuts and, of course, the escalating war spending that's going on and the fact that we're still allowing the pharmaceutical companies to gouge everybody. You know, that costs the government $50 billion a year just in Medicaid and Part D Medicare and so forth. And, of course, the rest of us. All right. So we'll come back to that as well. And then I want to talk about the China trade war and NAFTA. But let's keep talking about this global financial fragility rising, okay? At its core is this big bond sell-off going on in the U.S. and globally. You see, the U.S. interest rates now drive interest rates around the world. The other central banks are becoming appendages of the Fed. Yeah, sometimes they go in opposite directions of the Fed, but that's also an indication of they are responding to the Fed. The Fed drives global interest rates, and the Fed is raising interest rates, as we've said, rapidly, and that's driving up bond rates. It's also driving up the value of the dollar. Well, the value of the dollar is causing an emerging markets currency crisis, which leads to capital flight and recession in emerging markets. And now that we have this big surge this week in bond rates, bond prices move opposite to bond yields or interest rates. If bond yields are rising, which they are, then the price of bonds are declining. Okay, here's another interesting development this past week. Right. Now, today, yesterday and today, we're seeing the stock markets correct. In other words, stock prices are falling. I think the stock prices today, 300, we're down 300 basis points or something here today. Well, we'll see. It's not over yet. But the stock price is falling and bond price is falling because bond rates are rising. Now we got both stocks and bonds moving in the same direction, a downward deflation. Right? We also have oil prices now beginning to slip because oil prices followed the dollar and commodity prices. In other words, the key indicator of global financial stress is declining financial asset prices. Bonds are declining. Stocks are now beginning to decline, U.S. and especially in emerging markets. Oil prices will now decline. Commodity prices, a general Financial asset price deflation is the canary in the coal mine of the global economy, and it's weakening. Right? Up until now, you know, all this euphoria about the trade deal over the past week or so, week and a half here, the trade deal with NAFTA has kept stock prices up, even though the more fundamental development was working its way through the economy. More fundamental development meaning a rate, interest rate, Fed interest rate hikes, and therefore pressure on global bonds to decline. Even though that was building, you know, the herd investors believe that, you know, oh, well, we got this big deal. There'll be no trade war with NAFTA. Well, as you know, I've been saying that whole thing has been a phony trade war from the beginning, as have all of the so-called trade disputes between the U.S. and its allies. The only real trade war is with China. And boy, you're going to see that intensify soon, even though it's intensified quite a bit already. And we'll talk about that. Okay, so now we're beginning to see the ascendance of the Fed rate hikes and the bond sell-off taking precedence over this phony euphoria about no trade war in NAFTA. Now it's beginning to, the more fundamental, the real causes are reasserting themselves over the phony trade war. Okay, so watch bonds. Watch the bond development in the bond markets. As I've said, the bond markets are huge. They're far larger than the stock markets, and the bond markets are really at the core of global capitalism. And if they have a crisis, if there's a crisis in bonds, be it government bonds or what's called sovereign bonds, or be it corporate bonds, and the corporate bonds are more exposed, especially that part of corporate bonds called junk bonds. Those are the zombie companies, you know, that have extended their lifespan here by borrowing at very, very low rates that the Fed kept, that enabled them to roll over the debt and survive, even though they could not survive another recession. And now, of course, we're going to see the coming to the end of the zombies. And we're seeing this globally, right? We're seeing this globally, this bond crisis and defaults. Defaults means a company cannot pay its principal and interest on its bond debt, right? Then it defaults. If it defaults, what happens is the government has to step in, arrange a merger of that company, bankruptcy courts will sell off some of its better assets, and investors will take a loss, and stock, those who bought the company's stock will take a total loss. The bondholders will get some payment based upon selling off the real assets of the company and so forth. All right. So if you look at beyond just the U.S. and the bond increases and yields, rate hikes, and its coming impact on the stock markets and junk bond markets, corporate junk bond markets. Look what it's doing globally. It's intensifying emerging market crises. You know, it stabilized a little bit in recent weeks, the emerging market crises. The IMF coughed up $57 billion emergency loans to bail out Argentina. That won't be enough. It's a record for IMF, but it won't be enough. And then what if you have 2, 3, 4 Argentinas around the world? Is the IMF going to bail all of them out? I don't think the IMF can do it this time. And even Argentina won't be enough. Okay, so it's getting worse again. And the symptom for the crisis in emerging markets is the collapse of their currencies. Argentina, it's down 50% or 52% or something. And just in the last few days, it drops 3 to 4% a day additional. the currency, the Argentine peso. That's an indicator it's getting worse. And when the currency declines, well, guess what? Investors in Argentina want to get the hell out of Argentina in the peso because they're losing paper profits. So they sell the Argentina peso on world markets and buy, guess what? Dollars that are rising. Well, that depresses the Argentine peso even more, which causes a circular effect of the same thing happening even more intensely. Well, what does Argentina and these other countries do to try to stem that outflow of that currency and the decline of the currency? Well, what they do is they raise their domestic interest rates to try to keep investors, you know, if you're going to dump pesos for dollars, well, you know, I'm instead of dumping it for dollars, if the interest rate is high enough in Argentina, I'll just, you know, buy government bonds in Argentina, Argentine sovereign debt bonds, and keep my money in Argentina. So that's what they do. But when you raise your domestic interest rates, it sends you into a domestic recession, you see. Interest rates rise. So you get unemployment, massive unemployment, as interest rates rise, which is what the capitalists do to protect the value of their investors' wealth, raise interest rates. But that causes massive unemployment. At the same time, the collapsing currency causes significant inflation because most of the goods in these other countries are imported goods. And if your currency collapses, well, then, you know, the price of what you pay for other goods rises. So you get stagflation at record levels. Stagflation being rising unemployment and rising prices. Well, that's beginning to happen as well more intensely this past week and will continue. So renewed crisis in Argentina and Turkey, I might add. Right? And it looks like Brazil. And it's been spilling over and affecting Asian currencies like the Indonesia rupiah and the Indian rupee. Yeah, they've been declining too. And even the euro. Now, let's turn to Europe. What's the financial fragility locus in Europe? Well, it's Italian banks and Italian bonds, and to some extent, Euro banks. And now Greek banks are in trouble again, and Turkish banks are in trouble again. But the Italian banks, and even the German banks, Deutsche Bank and Commerce Bank, right? Of course, the Germans can bail them out, but they're having problems as well. When U.S. bond yields rise, it drives the euro down, and it causes bond yields to rise in Europe. Well, already Italian banks, the bond yields are rising because Italian banks are in trouble. Italy has hundreds of billions of dollars in non-performing bank loans. And we got this fight going on now between the new populist five-star coalition and the European Troika. In other words, the European Central Bank and European Commission, so forth, right? The Italians, with this new populist government, are saying, no, we got to stimulate our economy. Well, if you stimulate your economy, you're going to have a bigger budget deficit spending, and you're going to break the Eurozone rule of only so much percent of GDP deficit. If you do that, you send a signal that everybody else can do that too in the Eurozone. You see, that's what happened with Greece, but Greece was tiny. You know? And the European Troika just slapped Greece down and bought off its populist government, and they became an appendage of the European Central Bank. Well, Italy's a little bit bigger, you see. Italy may be a repeat of the Greek debt crisis in Italy, and it remains to be seen whether its populist government in Italy will go the way of the Greek populist party, the Syriza, and cave in to the Eurozone, or whether it will go its own direction and insist on taking care of its economy, because the way the Eurozone is set up, it's all to the benefit of Germany and Northern Europe. Okay, but Italian banks are in trouble. Monte dei Paschi Bank and the UBI Banca, they've been in trouble for some time. But even the big one, the UniCredit, biggest bank in Italy, is in trouble. And we'll see. But if their bond prices keep rising, it's going to get worse. And the bond prices will keep rising if bond prices in the U.S., bond rates, yields, if bond yields, rates in the U.S. keep rising, which they will because the Fed is continuing on raising interest rates. You see how the U.S. economic policy, monetary policy drives the crises in these other countries through the central bank, the Federal Reserve? There's other ways the U.S. drives the crises, too, by slapping sanctions, trying to rearrange the trade relationships, which is what they're doing now to the advantage of the U.S. at the expense of the rest of the world. That's what this trade thing is about. All right, so we have a global bond price collapse going on and bond yields rising and the dollar rising and interest rates rising, which spills over to intensifying emerging market crises. And in Europe, the focal point is Italian banks, but also other banks there as well. Now, another indicator of troubles going on is the appearance now of defaults. Corporate defaults, cracks, are beginning to appear. These zombie companies, the worst, are beginning to show. You know, the water, the rocks are beginning to appear above the water. And what are they? Well, we've had a couple in Europe already, but watch what's going on in India. India has this company, ILNFS. I don't know what the acronym stands for. But it has issued a lot of bonds that now it can't pay. And the government there is trying to step in somehow and contain the problem. Because if the corporate bonds for ILNFS collapse, and they've issued quite a few, then it will cause a contagion effect on other bonds and other companies. And who knows where that goes? India is also a problem with non-performing bank loans, like Italy. Officially, they say $135 billion in loans that aren't being paid for in India. Actually, it's probably double that, at least. So there's a bond problem, corporate bond problem now, and there's a corporate loan problem in India, and its currency is declining as part of this emerging market trend. So watch what's happening there. The contagion could spread throughout India and thereafter to global banks that have loaned India a lot of money. Okay, I mentioned watch out for what's going on with Deutsche Bank. The German government is trying to merge Deutsche with Commerzbank, also in trouble, as a solution. But now we're beginning to see signs that Greek banks are in trouble again, as well as Italian banks. Right? In the U.S., very significant here. A lot of news beginning to appear about General Electric in trouble. General Electric, massive company, used to be the biggest company in the U.S. in terms of wealth and employment and so forth. It's a global company, okay? But GE, watch what's going on with GE. They won't let GE collapse. You know, it's like GM, letting GM collapse in 2008. They won't do it, but the fact that GE is in more and more trouble will have a psychological effect on the rest of investors in the U.S. So watch it. U.S. hedge funds are beginning to close their doors, right? Distribute what they've got amongst their investors, their private investors. Why are they doing this? Some big ones, right? Maybe they see it's time to get out early before the crisis actually hits and they lose all their value and they have nothing to distribute to their members. So some big hedge funds, this is kind of a canary in the shadow banking coal mine here, are beginning to close. Junk bonds we've talked about in the U.S. are in trouble. And if junk bonds have a problem, right now they're only returning 2%, you know. This is a signal. If the junk bonds are returning 2% and corporate bond prices are rising, you better get out of those companies that are loaded up with junk debt. And you're going to see investors start bailing from those companies with only 2% return. If the junk bond market in the U.S. has a crisis, it's going to spill over into what's called exchange-traded funds. In other words, this is a derivative. This is like mortgage bonds and subprime mortgage bonds of 2007 and 8 crisis, ETFs, exchange-traded funds, right, where you just bundle, like subprimes. You bundle mortgages and subprimes, and here you bundle, right, bonds into corporate bond ETFs. It's a derivative. The problem with derivatives and ETFs is when the prices start collapsing, you can't get out. And that means there's going to be a panic and even further crises, especially corporate junk bond ETFs. But if corporate junk bond ETFs are in trouble, well, then that's going to psychologically spill over to other forms of ETFs, including stock ETFs. You see, when these financial asset prices, securities prices, begin to collapse, it has a psychological contagion effect on investors in other financial assets. They see the problem and they conclude that, oh, you know, the market is peaked. Time to cash out, take our money and run to the sidelines. If there's enough of this, everyone starts panicking and running to the sidelines. And we're not too far from that if the Fed keeps raising its rates. Okay. Another problem is corporate pension funds. Watch out, corporate pension funds. Why? Up until September 30th, a few days ago, corporations could deduct their contributions to their private pension funds off of their tax bill. So they've been putting money into the private pension funds up until last week. Because now under the Trump tax law, after September 30th, they can't deduct their pension fund contributions from their tax bill. So now watch out. There won't be contributions to pension funds, and there could very well be a crisis in pension funds coming. And maybe that's what's behind what's happening to the long bonds, the 30-year bonds in the U.S. that I said now the yield is rising fast. Maybe corporate pension funds and insurance companies who are sort of similar dumping their 30-year bonds. Who knows? Well, something's happening at the high end of the bond market. That's where the problem has been this past week, not the low end. You know, the 10-year and the 30-year have jumped like a quarter of 1% here, like overnight almost. And that's sending the signal globally about a global bond sell-off everywhere. Okay. So these are all the default problems that are beginning to, potential default problems that are beginning to appear globally as a result of the bond sell-off, as we call it, as a result of rising rates on bonds, government bonds and corporate bonds, as a result of the Fed raising the federal funds rate and signaling more is coming. Right? So you see how the Fed is at the core of a lot of these problems. All right, so why is the Fed raising these rates if it's causing all these problems? Because, as I've said many times before, somehow it's got to raise $1 trillion a year now in order to fund a budget deficit caused by Trump tax cuts and war spending escalations. The Fed has to come up with money somehow to cover that $1 trillion a year deficit. Well, it's already signaled the next auction it's going to sell $230 billion. You know, it's got to come up with $1 trillion this year, so it's, and every year for the next 10 years, and probably more if there's a recession, right? It's got to come up with, well, it's going to sell $230 billion in one sale because of the deficit that we have. Now, if we keep raising the deficit by $1 trillion a year, which is going to happen, or more, right? We're going to have by 2028, next decade, the end of the decade that this Trump tax cut is in effect for, we're going to have, instead of a $21 trillion national debt, federal debt, we're going to have a $32 trillion debt. Now, with interest rates rising and the debt rising $1 trillion a year, guess what? The cost of the interest on the debt is going to balloon. Well, we already have a Congressional Budget Office estimate that interest on the debt this year is $390 billion. Almost, well, more than twice of what it was 2 years ago. Twice. 50% increase. Well, almost twice, okay? $390 billion, but guess what? By 2028, the conservative estimate is the interest on the debt due to the Trump tax cuts and spending is going to be $900 billion a year. We're going to be paying $1 trillion of interest on the debt. And who do we pay that to? We pay that to investors, to the wealthy folks. They're the ones who buy the government bonds and bills, the banks, the big corporations that are quasi-banks, and wealthy, super wealthy private investors in the U.S. and globally. $1 trillion, $900 billion conservative CBO estimate, $1 trillion a year. Well, where are they going to get that from? Well, they're going to take it out of Social Security, folks. That's coming. That's their next big attack. Medicare, Social Security, they're going to make grandma and grandpa pay because that's the only big pot of money. And then they're going to say, oh, you know, it's going bankrupt. Therefore, we got to cut the benefits. Okay, so that's where the deficits and debt are going in the U.S. $1 trillion. $1 trillion for war spending, Pentagon and defense, right? $1 trillion for interest on the debt, and we're cutting taxes for next 10 years. And by the way, Congress also passed last week quietly, the House passed a provision to make the Trump tax cuts permanent, not just for the 10 years that were in the original bill passed this past January, but now they want to make it permanent for their friends, their rich friends, forever and ever. $1 trillion. Okay, that's the deficit and debt, but you see how it all comes back. It all comes back to monetary policy. You know, this is what I talk about in my book, just published last year, which was Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy and the Coming Depression. Well, we're moving in that direction. Financial fragility is growing globally and in the U.S., and you can trace it all back to the Fed and interest rate hikes. Now, the Fed subsidized corporations for 6 years with near zero interest rates. Now it's raising rates because it has to pay for the deficit. from the tax cuts. And now it's fiscal policy, it's tax cutting that is subsidizing capitalism and corporations in the U.S. It used to be monetary policy under Obama, and now it's fiscal policy. Because the huge deficits and the debt, well, they have to raise the rates to pay for it. Well, how else are we gonna subsidize our corporate capitalist friends? Well, now we'll do it with tax cuts, you see. They're just shifting to fiscal policy and tax cuts. Well, that's the subject of my next book coming out early next year called The Scourge of Neoliberalism, Economic Policy from Reagan to Trump. Two books that show how the state, the capitalist state, is playing a bigger and bigger role in subsidizing the capitalists and their corporations than ever before in the 21st century, especially. Right? There are two companion works that say the same thing, essentially. And it's all about the state, the government, the national government, playing a bigger, bigger role, propping up and enriching the capitalist class, the 1%, the investor class. All right, that's what's going on. All right, so let's get back to some of the other topics here. What about Trump's NAFTA 2.0, the deals announced in the last 2 weeks with Mexico, and not just Mexico, but with Canada this past week? Okay, what's the deal? All right, well, Trump claims that this is a big deal. This is a big deal, all right? A major change going on. Not. The only change is the change of the name. The change of the name from NAFTA to the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Trade Agreement, USMCA Trade Agreement. You simply scratched out the name NAFTA and put USMCA. Why? Because there's very little that actually changed in these deals. Now, here's the major elements. I'm going to be writing something in print, more detail, summarizing these deals all along since the spring, when the Trump trade war was launched in March with those tariffs on steel and aluminum. I've been saying Trump is engaging in a phony trade war with the U.S. allies. That became clear with the South Korean deal. South Korea, I think, the second or third biggest steel importer to the U.S. The renegotiated South Korean free trade deal that occurred some months ago, did it do anything about steel imports to the U.S.? No, it exempted Korea totally from steel imports. No more tariff increases on steel from South Korea. And, some token stuff about cars, car quotas and truck quotas. And the South Koreans were, ecstatic. Whoa, we got away. We got away with it, right? And I predicted that NAFTA would be the same, and it is. If you look at the major elements, let's look at Mexico. No increased tariffs on steel or anything else from Mexico. Mexico is a major steel importer to the U.S. as well. No increase in auto or auto part tariffs. There's a side letter. It's not in the agreement with Mexico of a week or so ago, but there's a side letter that says the U.S. for the next 16 years, I think this thing is in effect for 16 years, will not raise tariffs on autos at all. From current levels. And Mexico, most of the U.S. car industry moved to Mexico. You ever hear of this company called Delphi Auto Parts? It used to be the biggest auto parts manufacturer out of Ohio in the U.S., employed 100,000 workers in the U.S. They all moved everything, 20 plants, to Mexico, right? Auto parts. And it just sends it across the border, right? Okay, so Delphi and all the others, no increase in tariffs. Well, what were the auto deal terms here with Mexico in this NAFTA 2.0 oh, Mexico, you know, apart from no increase in auto tariffs, Mexico's got to raise its wages on auto workers to $16 an hour. But it doesn't say how quickly, but it does say no more than 40% of auto workers' wages. So 40% at some point are supposed to get $16 an hour. And then the other provision was North American content has to be increased from 62.5 to 75% in autos and auto parts. Well, what does that mean? Well, because Mexico was importing the cheapest parts from Asia. Now Mexico has to produce those auto parts, at least 12.5% more of it, in Mexico itself. North American content, not U.S. content. That's not going to affect anything as far as U.S. auto employment production in the U.S. Mexico just make more of it themselves. And those are the main provisions. And the dispute mechanism, which was at the core of Trump saying, we got to change this because it's trade disputes, because this is disadvantageous to American businesses. This is a non-negotiable, must be changed. Nope, no change whatsoever in the dispute mechanism. So autos are off the hook, no more tariffs, nothing changes in terms of steel, and dispute mechanism the same. Okay, those are what appears to be the major elements. We'll look at that in greater detail here once we get a copy, get my hands on a copy of the actual deal, which I haven't been able to. You know, I've tried to go to the U.S. Trade Representative, USTR website and everything, but I can't seem to find anything yet. What about the Canada deal announced just this past week? Well, more of the same. More of the same. No change in really aluminum and steel tariffs. But what has changed? Well, the autos, once again. Mexico imports about 2.4 million cars into the U.S., and who knows how much in the value of auto parts that come to the U.S. and are included in autos that are assembled in the U.S. You see, the big three companies are really auto assembly companies in the U.S., GM, Ford, etc., Chrysler. Well, Chrysler isn't even an American company anymore. It's Italian. 2.4 million fully assembled cars come in the U.S. from Mexico. How many come in from Canada? 2 million more. Okay. So what's been imposed on Canada? What's part of the Canada NAFTA deal? Part of the Canada NAFTA deal is, we're going to set a quota on how many cars Canada can import into the U.S. Canada's importing 2 million. Oh, you can import 2.6 million Canada. Well, what is that? You know, that's a phony number. They're not even near 2.6 million and 2 million right now. But even the 2.6 million ceiling is only going to be in effect if Trump imposes a 25% tariff on all global auto imports to the U.S. Only then does the 2.6 quota limit come into effect. So there's nothing. What did Trump get? Well, he didn't get the dispute mechanism change he wanted. That stays exactly the same. Oh, he got an increase in U.S. dairy imports to Canada of 3.5%. In other words, Wisconsin and Michigan dairy farmers, Vermont dairy farmers, can sell an increase of 3.5%, and Canada is going to offset that with subsidies to its dairy farmers. Well, those are the main elements that I've been able to discern. I haven't seen anything more than that, but we'll see. Right? Now, with this phony NAFTA deal's concluded, now the intensification of trade war with China is beginning to occur. Right? All the editorials and signals are coming of we're going to intensify our focus and attack on China. You know, Trump has already announced $250 billion tariffs on China. That's where you see the real tariffs, you see. But it's more than that. As I've been saying all along, the real reason for the trade war with China is technology. And China's 2025 program of trying to be the leader by 2025 in the next generation technologies, 5G wireless, cybersecurity, and artificial intelligence. These are the industries of the future, and these are also the military technologies of the future. And the three trade factions in the U.S. are the bankers who want more access to Chinese markets. Agriculture, U.S. agriculture wants to have Chinese buy more U.S. agriculture, and the defense establishment, the war establishment, defense companies, intelligence agencies, Pentagon. What they're concerned about is the technology, you see. And now they have the ear of Trump, right? For a while there, it was it looked like the U.S. bankers were the ones that were able to drive the negotiations. And they almost had a deal with China. China opened up its markets to U.S. 50% and even signaled 100% ownership of Chinese companies, which is what the bank U.S. bankers want. And said it would purchase $100 billion more in agricultural goods. Well, it satisfied two of the three areas of demands, but it didn't agree to technology limitations. So now there's a big war going on about technology between the U.S. and China. One of the casualties of that was this Chinese company called ZTE, which a telecom company which the U.S. claims was buying its way into technology companies in the U.S. and stealing U.S. technologies, right? They call that intellectual property. The U.S. pretty much gave the deep six to ZTE, said you couldn't any longer do business in the U.S., right? That was the way that the defense faction in the U.S. reasserted, with the help of its friends in Congress, reasserted its role as dominant in U.S. negotiations with China, trade negotiations. All right, so Trump sucks up to anything that has to do with military, you know, big draft dodger, right? Guilty, whatever. And, you know, he loves his military folks, anybody in uniform. So now they have his ear, and that's the dominant faction in the U.S. Now, it was ZTE. What's the signal that we got a big escalation coming in the trade war with China? It's this thing that's just hit the press here this past week about, and is being pumped up all over by the prestitute press, as Paul Craig Roberts accurately calls it, the prestitute, the traditional media, pumping up the whole idea that somehow China has gotten a chip, a microchip, embedded in this small company, Micron something, and this small company somehow has its servers sold to all the big corporations and government in the U.S. so that China has this microchip window now into all U.S. companies, right? And, of course, Micron, whatever its name is, denies this totally. And Google and others deny this, right? But the denials are being overwhelmed by the media push that China's using this secret chip to get into our biggest corporate and military secrets, right? This is an intelligence agency play, in my opinion. This is like yellow cake. Remember yellow cake as the excuse to go in into Iraq, you know? This chip thing is a yellow cake false thing, whatever. I don't know what you would call it. It doesn't. I don't see any proof. I don't see how technologically China could get its chip embedded in all these places, and how having its chip embedded, it's sucking out all this technology and secrets from the U.S. Business and the government. It just doesn't, I don't see any proof. It seems very, very, very scary, right? All right, so quickly, Trump's silver spoon, New York Times, this big expose of Trump. Trump says he got $1 million from his dad. That's all he had to pay back with interest. That's how he's made his billions. All the records the New York Times turned up showed how $413 million he got from his dad. And, you know, at the heart of this is really the use of by the wealthy of their foundations, how they move money around with gift taxes and estate taxes, and real estate property especially gets moved around, undervalued and undertaxed, so forth. The New York Times, of course, is not looking at the foundations of Trump, and they should be looking at all the foundations, because this is how the wealthy folks use their foundations as slush funds to move the money around amongst their family members and even between each other. There should be a general investigation of the foundations and the games they play. Okay, before we finish here in the next couple of minutes, I want to say something about the tax cuts and wages. Now we got reports coming out that show, you know, Mercer LLC Research, Adecco Staffing, Just Capital, and some of these other research firms are showing that the Trump tax cuts are being passed on into wages between 0 and 7% of the tax cuts are going into wages. That's all. And most of that going into lump sums and pension contributions and so forth. That's why we're not getting any wage increases. You know, the tax cuts aren't going to the workers. They're all going into stock buybacks and dividends and mergers and acquisitions and hoarding. All right. The last thing I want to say in the last minute here, I think I have, is while all this is going on, particularly with Kavanaugh, some really scary stuff is happening behind the scenes. We have Kay Hutchinson, who is the Trump ambassador to NATO, threatening Russia, threatening that Russia, you better stop the development of your next generation missiles here, or we're going to use U.S. missiles to take them out. Wow. We're going to send missiles to attack missile bases in Russia? Is that what she's saying? Whoa, that's crazy. Even if she doesn't mean it to say it, the Russians, of course, were furious, because they see U.S. putting a radar and missile bases and sending U.S. divisions into Poland and the Baltics after this coup they engineered in Ukraine. What do you expect Russia to do? Russia looks like the U.S. is preparing for war with them. This missile threat, and now also threats also occurring simultaneously, that the U.S. is planning to attack Russian bases in Syria, if necessary? What's going on here? This is outrageous. This is neocon extremism going on. And who is this? Is this coming from Trump, or is this coming from the defense establishment independently? And now we got this big editorial by Peter Navarro, the real hawk, and Bolton Hawks, who have Trump's ear now, saying we got to really increase defense spending next generation. Okay, so keep that last thing in mind and read between the lines of what's going on with these threats.